you hate government, one of them libertarian types, or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, guys. How's it going? Welcome back. On the line, I got Eric Margolese from EricMargolese.com. Spell it like Margolis. EricMargolese.com. He wrote the books War at the Top of the World and American Raj, Liberation or Domination. You can also find what he writes at the Uns Review. That's Uns.com. And at LouRockwell.com. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Eric?
Hello, Scott. Happy to be back with you.
Good, good. Very happy to have you on the show. So, I want to ask you mostly about Yemen and then maybe some other things. But first of all, can we talk a little bit about your latest article, Churchill's Disaster? This is about the centennial of this horrible battle in World War One, and I've never heard anybody say the word out loud. I've only read it, so I'll let you take it from there.
Well, today is, in fact, the commemoration in Turkey of the Battle of Gallipoli in 1915. It's also Anzac Day, Australia and New Zealand Day, when they sent troops for the first time to fight in a British colonial war, as I call it. And it's an important day for Turkey because it was a significant victory for the dying Ottoman Empire, and it really marked the beginning of modern Turkey. So in a political sense, it was a very important event. In a military sense, it was a huge disaster, and the man most responsible for it was First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill. Mm-hmm.
And now, so where is Gallipoli, and what happened there? What was the big deal?
Oh, okay. Well, take your mind to the Black Sea above Turkey, or below Turkey, above Turkey, and then go a little bit south, Istanbul, formerly Constantinople, down the small Sea of Marmara, and then you come to these two long fingers of land that go south into the Aegean, and they are known, that's where Gallipoli is. It's known as the Straits, Turkey, it's a very strategic area. It's been fought over ever since the Iron Age, practically, because it's the only water maritime transit from the Aegean and the Mediterranean up into the Black Sea into Russia.
And so what was so difficult about the British invasion there?
Well, it was very poorly planned. First of all, the British... They could have used drones that we use now. They had a poor understanding of how difficult the topography was there. I've walked over the entire area. It's two long peninsulas of land. It's very pockmarked with ravines and gullies and very steep, very dry and hot and uncongenial for fighting, but that's what happened. The French and then the British thought that a quick maritime naval strike using their Mediterranean fleets could force the Dardanelles open and allow them to steam north to Constantinople, shell the city, and not only knock Turkey out of the war, because Turkey was a principal German ally along with Austria-Hungary, but also open a supply line to Russia, which was suffering and at the time starting to lose the war. That was the plan, but it didn't work out that way because the Turks put up a ferocious defense and they mined, I think it was 8 Western French and British battleships, couldn't fight their way by the old forts, and then the British and the Anzacs were landed around Sulva Bay and other areas, and they became immediately bogged down in the very difficult uphill topography, and the war became stalemated.
And now, so how many people died in this thing?
Well, we think about 250,000 on either side. Once again,
so that's like a couple of years worth of the Iraq War.
That's right. We got 500,000 total dead, and the both sides fought very valiantly. The Turks, because out of this, a Turkish local commander named Mustafa Kemal seized command of his weakening Turkish troops, made the famous pronouncement, "I am not ordering you to fight, I'm ordering you to die." In other words, die where you stand. The French did it too at Verdun, by the way. The Turks did, and the Turks went and were derided as the sick men in Europe, and the British, with their usual typical racism, sneered at the Turks as inferior human beings, found that these were very ferocious fighters, fought the Allies to a standstill, even though the Allies had all these battleships with big guns lying off the coast. But both sides suffered terrible privations because of logistics problems, lack of water, heat, lack of medical facilities. It was a bloodbath. And in the end, the Allies were defeated, forced to withdraw their troops, and Turks proclaimed a great victory. Turkey remained allied to Germany, and the war was not ended in one big coup. And Winston Churchill, whose idea was forced to resign as First Lord of the Admiralty, and he, to his credit, I must say, as sort of a penance, he went and took up command of a British army regiment on the Western Front and served there pretty much toward till the end of the war.
Hmm. Well, now, so I guess the lesson for me here is, wow, they'll really throw 250,000 of their own guys away on a battle that they cannot win. And over what period of time did this take place?
2 years.
Well, yeah, so there you go. I guess that's like total casualties from the Iraq War for about 2 years worth of time period there. So yeah, although that's only one small part of the entire First World War that we're talking about here.
Yeah,
one battle.
Most of the fighting was in 1915 in 1 year. You know, I have made a mistake here, Scott. I can't remember now whether 250,000 were dead or dead and wounded.
Oh, I guess you say dead or were wounded in the article here.
Okay, well, then that's the right answer.
Yeah. That's still a freaking catastrophe. And there were other, you mentioned some of the other battles there where they just, where the officers and the politicians behind them just perfectly happy to throw piles of lives on top of machine gun nests to no good end whatsoever.
That's right, Scott. The next year later, the Battle of the Somme, I think it was in 16, the British lost 24,000 dead on one day of the battle. So lives were worth nothing in those days.
But all this reminds me of the thing going on with Russia right now. Because as bad as America's policy in the Middle East is, it mostly only hurts them and sometimes some office workers here in America. But the war all pretty much takes place over there. But when we're talking about screwing around with the Russians in Ukraine and all that, that's the kind of blowback that can hit home in an intercontinental ballistic missile kind of a way. And it's stories like this that make me wonder, you know, I guess I want to believe that somebody up there, even if it's Dr. Strangelove or somebody, he's got a plan. He at least thinks he knows what he's doing. But then when I read articles like this, about Gallipoli and especially all of World War One, it really makes me think that you could actually just grab the staff of the local Sonic Burger and put them in charge of the National Security Council, and they'd be just about as qualified, maybe even better qualified, to make these decisions than the people who are making them, who seem to have no trouble picking a fight far beyond the kind of fight that they ought to be picking, like when we're talking about screwing around in Ukraine, when we got a ceasefire and then we send in a bunch of troops to train theirs and arm them up and take them back to war. And now I talked us all the way to the damn break, but that's where we're going to pick up this conversation on the other side, is the boobery and incompetence ? On the National Security Council back then, 100 years ago, and today. And then we're going to talk about Yemen, too. It's the great Eric Margolies, author of American Raj, Liberation or Domination. EricMargolies.com. Hey, all Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Eric Margolies about his latest piece, Churchill's Disaster, Gallipoli. And then, so the question is about, you know, just how dangerous are our current leaders? Are they willing to get us into World War One level, crises? Or has the lesson been learned? After all, it was 100 years ago. And if anybody ever learned a lesson of anything, it was that they didn't want to do another World War One kind of thing, right? I don't know. But then we have, I was trying to get to in my question, too, the idea that they do know what they're doing, maybe, and that, hey, Putin, you know we're just trying to sell some weapons and make some money and whatever. We don't really mean you any harm. We're not really going to put Ukraine in NATO. We're just screwing around and making some money, and you can tolerate that, right? Or maybe it's not that organized. Maybe they really could get us into a war with Russia right now. I don't know. What do you think, Eric?
I refer your listeners to a wonderful book called The Sleepwalkers by Professor Clark from Britain. It is the most detailed and thorough analysis of how World War One started. And it is fascinating because it shows that the war was started by small numbers of militant-minded officials. For example, in France, who hated the Germans because of the loss of Alsace-Lorraine in the 1870 war, and the British, some British officials who were fearful of Germany's economic might and jealous of its growing power, idiots in the Austro-Hungarian establishment who thought that they could just go to war with Serbia, etc. Anyway, he gives a very fine, what the takeaway from the book is that the war wasn't started by a broad consensus, but by a couple of bloody-minded people who managed to sway government policy and direct it so that the war eventually did come to be. Mm-hmm. This is what we're happening now here, too.
All right, now, but so here's the thing, though. I mean, we do have the mutually assured destruction thing, which everybody understands. And I know that there's a push to try to make our forces so superior that we can do the successful first strike and all of that kind of thing. But basically, the people on the National Security Council, they are aware that the Russians have H-bombs and that we can only push things so far, right? But, I mean, I guess it's just a calculated risk and don't worry about it or what? I'm trying to understand the thinking of the people who would get us into this level of crisis over a country as far away as Ukraine, you know?
It's influenced by arrogance, primarily, and hubris. Just as the British sneered at the Turks as third world Muslims who couldn't fight, the people in the American security structure, of course they know the Soviets couldn't retaliate, and they have a very strong nuclear force too, but they think that we're the greatest, we're the exceptional nation, they know that we're the 800-pound gorilla, and they're gonna back down. We're just gonna bully them out of these positions. They can't afford to stand up to us. Well, it's a stupid position. It's one that has no understanding of history, and it puts nitwits like Condoleezza Rice under the Bush administration dangerously in charge of policy with their fingers on the nuclear trigger.
Man. So do you think at this point the policy is with the new equipment and the training going on over there that, I mean, is it even as well thought out as, yes, we do mean to help the Ukrainian military build itself up to enough strength that they can reconquer Donetsk and Luhansk, however you pronounce them correctly there?
Well, they should be relabeled as no interest to America. It's shocking that we're involved in a sideshow in Ukraine that could lead to a nuclear clash in an area where, about which we know nothing and where we have no interest and never will. It's bloody-mindedness that's doing it. And the idea that we could stick our finger in Russia's eye, maybe this is the first step to the dismantling of the Russian Federation, as the neocons are calling. All in all, it's a very perilous equation. Training a few Ukrainian troops, not going to do the trick. A nasty person might say, well, look, the Americans have done so well in the Vietnam War and in Iraq, and that these are the same guys who are teaching their military skills to the Ukrainians. Maybe they would better go with another teacher, like the Germans or something like that. Anyway, I'm being facetious, but no, what this is, it's a political gesture, but it's sufficiently provocative to risk the advent of a war. And Britain and Canada have also sent troops, small penny packets of troops.
Yeah, it's amazing. Just enough to make the point, they think, the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? This is all, or at least in the movie of it, this is all language, you know, having a quarantine instead of a blockade and having the ships, you know, cut their path off but not drop depth charges or, you know, whatever, this kind of thing. This is all the diplomatic language of actually moving forces around. And for politics' sake, like you say, but it's provocative enough that it really could do the trick. And they're basically screwing around in order to keep John McCain quiet or something, I guess. They're willing to go this far.
Well, you know, we have to understand that the president is under tremendous pressure from the fire-breathing Republicans who never met a war they didn't like and are ready to fight to the last mercenary in the U.S. Army. Just as long as their sons don't have to go to war. They're not scared of wars. We haven't seen one since the Civil War. So it's easy to, but I remember, unfortunately, I'm old enough to remember when we sent our first advisors to Vietnam. That's how it all started. And then the advisors needed troops to protect them. And they couldn't rely on the Vietnamese troops. And then so we decided to send more troops. But then the more troops needed yet more troops. And, well, hence the term from Vietnam, mission creep. And I'll predict that the same thing will happen in Ukraine.
Crazy. Well, and again, back to the obvious ending of that, if nobody puts a halt to it, is nuclear fusion. And temperatures to make the sun seem cool and that kind of thing. So we definitely don't need that. If anybody can do anything about it, go ahead, please. Let me switch to Yemen here. So they said that there is a convoy of Iranian ships heading to Yemen. And they've turned around. And they were accused of having weapons, but apparently nobody ever showed that. I don't know. So the New York Times had two different stories. And maybe they were a day apart, Eric, but one was America's urging the Saudis to stop bombing Yemen. And then the next day, I guess it was, Obama urges Saudi Arabia to continue bombing, announcing the job is not done. Does that mean that Obama thinks that the Saudis can get a regime change from the air and that the war ought to continue until then?
I think so, or maybe troops will be introduced. The Saudis tried to get to rent Pakistani army, which is a very good army, very crack soldiers. And the Pakistanis wisely turned them down. They don't want to get involved. But just over the horizon are the Egyptians and Egypt's bloody-minded dictator, U.S.-supported dictator, al-Sisi, has offered troops for Yemen. So it's possible, and soon, that we could see convoys of Egyptian ships bringing troops down and going into combat in Yemen, which will be the first time since the Egyptian army was in action in Yemen in the early 1960s.
Wow. And now, I'm sure you saw this thing by Mark Perry in Al Jazeera about the American generals saying that this is crazy. Why are we flying as Al-Qaeda's air force when these guys aren't even backed by Iran, and who cares if they were anyway, kind of a thing. But it seems like Obama's position isn't even reluctant. He's actually pushing this thing to go further when it seemed like the Saudis were willing to back down.
Well, it's very hard to tell. You know, there was an interesting article, again, talking about the New York Times. I think it was in yesterday, so the day before, about the late Richard Holbrooke, who was U.S. ambassador to the Balkans and a Kissinger man. And Holbrooke said in his memoirs that that the president, that we have a weak president who's unusually pushed around by the military complex. And I think this is true. The president of the White House is under all kinds of differing pressures. It's being besieged by the Israel lobby. It's got the Pentagon after them. It's got big business which wants more weapons contracts. It's got financial problems. The Democrats are screaming that, you know, you've got to do something, otherwise the Republicans are going to be here at the next election. So they're confused and stumbling, and there's incoherence on foreign and military policy at present.
All right, now, at the Moon of Alabama blog, they found a story about, it's amazing, about, well, I guess not that surprising, but it's about the Saudis flying in weapons straight to the Al-Qaeda forces in Yemen and having them rename themselves. Let me see if I have it here. They're popular committees now, and this one is now called the Hadramaut Brigade or whatever, but all the Sons of Hadramaut. And all it is Al-Qaeda. They just renamed themselves so that now they can get Saudi weapons. The Moon of Alabama guy's joking that he actually was joking that, oh, now that Al-Qaeda has taken this air fort, now the Saudis can fly in a bunch of guns. And then it came true a couple of days later.
Well, the situation in Yemen is extremely confusing. It's hard to know who's who there and who's supporting who. And, you know, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Saudis were arming radical groups. But, you know, we put all these labels on these people, which confused everyone, but primarily ourselves. They're Al-Qaeda everywhere in Yemen. It's mostly tribal fighting. It's not ideological. It's not nothing to do with foreign attacks or anything like that. I've been in Yemen since the 60s, and they're all shooting at each other, and the tribes switch sides after a few days, or some bakshish payments under the table. So it's hard to know. And the situation with the diplomats are called very fluid.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we can see that right now where everyone seems to agree that the former dictator is now behind his former enemies, the Houthis, who I used to interview you back a couple of years ago about his war against them, and now he's their guy, or they're his, and in war against, I guess, the socialists, who I saw a documentary where these guys say, everybody says we're Al-Qaeda. Why don't you ask us? We're for Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. Yeah. Viva revolution.
That would clarify matters exceptionally. The former president, Al-Hadi, who we installed him in Yemen. I mean, we were running Yemen. The U.S. was running Yemen as a little colony. And we installed this two-by-nothing Hadi there because we got tired of the former president we were just talking about, Mr. Saleh. This Hadi is a little drip and was not respected by anyone and eventually run out of the country. And he's also a Saudi puppet, so the Saudis are not trying to put him back in power. But Saleh is reasserting himself, and it's a big mess.
Yeah, sure as hell is. All right, well, I kept you over time, so I'll let you go about your day. But thank you again for your time on the show, Eric. I sure appreciate it.
Cheers, Scott.
All right, y'all, that's the great Eric Margolese. His website is ericmargolese.com, spelled like Margolis. ericmargolese.com. Also, you can find him at lourockwell.com and at unz.com, U-N-Z, unz.com. The books are American Raj, Liberation or Domination, and War at the Top of the World. And we'll be right back in a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.